from KQED.
Welcome to the Spur Urban Center. Thank you all for being here tonight. My name is Ryan Davis, and I am the Director of Live Events at KQED, and we're very pleased to have you join us for this evening. This event is part of KQED On Common Ground, which is a new live events program in partnership with local cultural institutions who are likewise invested with public trust to bring people together for civil discourse about how to face a future of economic, cultural, and environmental uncertainty by asking the question, what are our shared responsibilities to the common good? This event series is part of our larger initiative, KQED 2020, that will, over the course of the next year, across all of our platforms, ask our audiences to consider what it means to participate in a democracy. Tonight's discussion, co-presented with our partners here at the member-supported urban planning think tank Spur, is the third in a series that explores the ways that economic inequality is fraying at the social fabric of the Bay Area and what we can do about it. And so without further ado, please join me in welcoming our panel and welcoming our host this evening, KQED's evening anchor and Friday Forum host, Mina Kim.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Ryan, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that members of this audience believe that every child has the right to a quality education. And one of the things that we have learned in California is to do that requires quite a bit of money. Even though there is that recognition, there's generally a sense that it is a very worthy investment because we recognize that an education is what propels the development of a robust civil society and also propels a robust economy, if that's one of the measures of success that you might hold. So one of the things that we want to explore tonight is where are we now in California after we've been disinvesting in education for a long time, and only recently, in the last decade or so, we've begun to reinvest back in education. What progress have we made, especially in light of the fact that as we've been doing this, there's been this concurrent, growing, widening gap in terms of income inequality? And income inequality has brought us tremendous consequences, including effects on access to housing, access to food, childcare, our health. It's affected our well-being. And of course, it's affected our schools. So we want to dig into how it is affecting our schools, which are being asked, as we all know, to deal with a lot of the realities that come with income inequality. So in addition to things that we want to address, we also want to look at strategies for change. And we'll do that within an hour with our three distinguished panelists. And I will start by introducing to you Dr. Patrick Murphy at the end there. He's been a policy director and senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, where he's focused on public finance, public management issues in K-12 and higher education. He's an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco, where he's held appointments as professor of politics, department chair, and director of the McCarthy Center for Public Service. Next week, he'll be joining Arnold Ventures, which is a philanthropic LLC, as its vice president of public finance. Thanks for being here, Patrick Murphy.
Thank you, Mina.
Next to him is Dr. Naila Suad Nasir. She is president of the Spencer Foundation, which gives grants for education research. She was a faculty member at UC Berkeley until 2017, where she served as vice chancellor of equity and inclusion, and she was a faculty member at Stanford School of Education until 2008. She's the author of Racialized Identities, Race and Achievement for African American Youth. Welcome, Naila Suad Nasir.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. And next to me is Dr. Kyla Johnson-Trammell. She's superintendent of Oakland Unified School District. She's been that since 2017, but she has served the district for more than 18 years as its interim deputy superintendent of academic and social emotional learning, as its lead network superintendent of elementary schools, and as a teacher, principal, director of talent development, and associate superintendent for leadership, curriculum, and instruction. And she also attended Oakland Public Schools as well. So welcome, Kyla Johnson-Trammell.
Thank you.
And I'm going to start with you. We are seeing unprecedented income inequality, and it's become a fundamental issue, a fundamental challenge that K-12 schools are dealing with right now. So if you had to isolate sort of the key ways that income inequality has affected your district, what would be at the top of that list?
I think that's part of the challenge, is that you can't isolate what the challenges are. I'm thinking a lot about just some of the NAEP scores that came out just around how our children are reading across our country.
And NAEP, for anybody who doesn't know.
National Educational, I think, Advancement Progress. It's just an assessment that just looks at across the nation how students are reading. And so overall, we're seeing not a lot of improvement for all, and most of our persistent gaps, particularly for African American and Latino students, no movement at all. Two outliers being Washington, D.C., I think, and Mississippi. The reasons for that are everything from preschool, and we don't have any form of universal preschool, and we know the average cost, at least in California, can be up to $10,000, $14,000 a year, so access to preschool. Obviously, the housing conversation in the Bay Area, the growing number of unhoused students and families are African American and Latino, and we talk a lot about unhoused, either on the streets, couch surfing, living in shelters, but then the next kind of vulnerable population are low income, who may be a month or 3 months away from being homeless because their housing situation is very unstable. So that leads directly to spikes in chronic absenteeism. We've had lots of situations where we have kids who may be in our school district 2 to 3 days a week and in another school district for the rest of the week because of where their housing situation is, right? And so chronic absenteeism is something many districts now are looking at because it's a predictor of, is the student going to be on track to be reading and ultimately graduating ready for college? So there are many factors, housing, obviously, food. We can get into just the stability of the workforce, of teachers and of principals, where now with the housing situation, it's becoming untenable to live in the Bay Area. And so that statistic, which has always been an issue, we have about a 40% teacher shortage across the nation in terms of the number of teachers that are leaving the profession in 5 years, it is a bigger issue in the Bay Area, in Oakland and San Francisco, both for teachers, paraeducators, preschool principals. And so in schools that for many decades that have large percentages of students of color, attrition has already been high. That is now spiking. And so the stability affects the obviously the quality of the school when you constantly have that flow. So all of those things together, which is why it's hard to kind of isolate one thing and why a lot of our educational reforms haven't worked, because we really need universities, private sector, government. It is a very nested, interwoven problem, and the solutions are going to be between all of those sectors as well.
Yes. I mean, you really laid out a lot in terms of, I'm just thinking about a student who is hungry, who isn't sure if they are not going to have the housing that they currently have, if their parent or caregiver isn't able to get the work needed to be able to afford secure housing and, you know, consistent food. So then, Naila Suad Nasir, how are children able to learn in those circumstances when they enter a school?
Right. Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's very difficult to learn when you don't feel safe. It is also not the case that all kids are attending schools that provide the same set of things. And actually, some of the things that we used to take for granted is really basic kinds of resources, librarians, nurses, social workers, psychologists. Many schools don't have the resources to have those kinds of positions filled. And so you have the very schools with the young people who are having the greatest need by virtue of their social circumstances in schools with the least ability to meet those needs. And what we know from the learning sciences is that just neurologically, you can't learn if you don't feel like you belong, if you don't feel safe, if you're hungry, if you're worried about where your next meal is coming or where you're going to sleep tonight. And so it really is a problem both for schools as institutions, but also thinking about how to create learning environments where young people have the ability to really engage, given all of the circumstances that they're managing.
Now, Patrick Murphy, though, in some ways, California has realized that children are coming into school with a lot of needs, and they're trying to trying to funnel more money to high needs districts, the local control funding formula, for example. So can you talk about right now what's guiding the state's philosophy in terms of how it's allocating money for California and whether or not it's working?
Oh, let me take the easy part of how it does it, and I might defer to my panelists on the how well it's working. The starting point when you're thinking about financing of schools in California is to realize that for most of the school districts in California, the state pretty much determines the bulk of the resources that they're going to receive. So it's not like a lot of other states in the United States where the local district has decision-making over that. We could have a whole nother session as to why, but I mean, Prop 13, I'll just say that changed things in the late 70s. So now what happens...
In terms of significantly reducing the property tax base that would go towards
And putting the state in charge of this sort of distribution. So now
exactly.
What happens is that the state legislature and the governor in passing the budget each year, driven by some other constraints and lots of details as always with these things, but basically determines the bulk of the money going out. In 2013, a change was made where in California, instead of trying to provide the same dollar amount per student to each school district, there was a recognition that certain school districts face bigger challenges. And so they instituted what is thought of, if you think of it as a weighted formula, a way in which you can provide additional resources based on the makeup of the school district. In California, we provide additional resources based on low-income students, students who are English language learners, and foster children. And we provide additional dollars to school districts that have more of those students. The other piece I would note is that in the last roughly 10 years, so if you go back to the lowest point we had during the Great Recession around 2009, the state has really increased the dollar amounts available to school districts by about 20% in real terms. So a significant tens of billions of dollars difference. You can sense a butt coming, can't you? Before the recession, we were below the national average in per pupil spending, and even after those tens of billions of dollars, we are still below the national average in per student spending. All of which is, I've just given you the numbers, that's what I do, that's what I specialize in, but then that raises another question that I would be remiss in not pointing out, which is, I can tell you what those numbers are, it's around $12,000 per student. What I can't tell you is that enough to actually achieve and address the problems that have already been discussed when you are actually faced with that student in your classroom or student in your school and realize the additional challenges that go with that. And there have been some efforts to do that, and a rough cut says that we're still about, depending on how you measure it, one number was at least about $20 billion short of what might be considered an adequate amount, $20 billion for the whole state, which on the basis of about $90-some billion, that's a lot of money.
So, I'm sorry, can you just remind me again what the national average is and what we're spending against the national average?
So, I'm qualifying this because I'll give you ballparks just simply because lots of people like to nitpick around these. We're about, say, $12,000. National average is maybe about 13.5, 14, depending on what numbers you use. I'm doing that in numbers. I'm not adjusting for the cost of, if you will, living in California, which we tend to be, if you will, I think everyone in this room knows, a high-cost state.
Yes. And so, Kyla Johnson-Trammell, is that enough for Oakland? For the 37,000 students that you have?
Absolutely
about exactly why it isn't.
Well, one, California, in comparison to other states, we have a high percentage. We're a very diverse state. I think the beauty of working in a district like Oakland and being in the Bay Area is also the challenge in terms of really making sure on the promise of educating all students. So if you think about the profile of a newcomer, right, if you think about the profile of a student who's first generation, I'm a firm believer, like I'm sure everyone in this room, every child has the capacity to become brilliant and just do whatever it is that they want to do, provided that they have the resources and the support. But when you think about that, we have some students who are coming to us maybe at the age of 14 from Guatemala, war-torn situations. And so to be at a position in order to be their best self, there's a need in terms of supports for the students. Sometimes they're coming with family, sometimes they're not coming with family. And so whether it's social worker, whether it's counseling, there may have been gaps. They've been in school, then they weren't in school. And so there is a cost to that. Without funding for that, that unintentionally falls on the backs of your individual teacher or your individual principal. And so that capacity can only go so far until there's certain gaps and certain needs that aren't met. So the whole kind of premise of the LCFF local control funding formula was that a school and or a district that serves a great percentage of students with need should get more. It was really grounded in equity. But the issue is that the base, right, is insufficient. With all of the funding, it's not necessarily keeping up with everything that it costs to educate a child 12 years ago, it's just going to be more now. So pensions, I'm sure there's been a lot of conversation around pension reform that's needed, that's really squeezing a lot of our districts because the funding for schools hasn't kept up with just the rising costs of operating a school and taking care of employees. That's what a lot of the strikes are about, right?
Yes.
Is that starts to eat into a district's ability to have working conditions, which salary is one piece of it, but if you follow many of the strikes across the country, it really gets into, I came into this profession as a teacher to serve the whole child. And so if I don't have at the school the nurses, the counselors, these other critical supports, those then squeeze and all of those things fall on a teacher. And the more students you have of need, there's just naturally going to be gaps if the resources are limited where those students aren't going to get, you know, what it is that they need. And so we're not yet at a place where we were prior to like 1978 where nurses, librarians, sports, and arts, we're not funding them as if they're core. Our mental model financially is that they're extracurricular. So if you can scrape together the dollars through PTA or other means, grants, then you're deserving of having those things. And that really is where you see a lot of the equity gaps. Even in a district like Oakland, that is urban, you can go to some parts of my district and you have all of those resources. And then you can go 10 or 15 minutes in the other direction and they're not there. So I've been pushing now, particularly when we're in this place where there's a push for Prop 13 reform. I think because of LCFF, many times folks think, well, why do I need to give more money? The schools have already had enough money. But it's really thinking about what are we educating for in the 21st century? Is it a core responsibility to make sure all kids know how to code? Is it a core responsibility to make sure all kids learn another language? Is being able to have PE so that we're not increasing the number of kids who are growing up with diabetes? Are those things that we say as a country, yes, we need to fund that? Then that's a totally different funding formula than we're talking about.
I would just add that the also wealthier communities raise money to supplement the base. So that's another really great mechanism that reproduces inequity is the nonprofit organizations that exist within wealthy districts where parents are supplementing sometimes to the tune of, you know, up to $1 million for those services.
Absolutely.
With all the challenges that we're talking about and the need for resources, it's easy to just sort of, I would think as an educator or as an administrator or as a superintendent, to kind of throw up your hands and just be like, wow, the challenges are so incredibly overwhelming. What can we really do to try to get at these really big things? And Naila Suad Nasir, one of the things that I was struck by in your research is that you said something about how schools have the potential to be these incredible disruptors of inequality, but they also are spaces where inequality is reproduced. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you could just talk about, just on the level of, I would imagine that as an educator, you would need to go into your classroom and say, okay, I'm just gonna do the best I can, given all of this for my kids, right? But what are some of the things that you've identified that may inadvertently or, you know, unconsciously be reproducing inequalities in schools.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to recognize that nationally and here in the Bay Area as well, we do not provide equal access to high-quality education in any way, shape, or form. Wealthier districts provide a fundamentally higher quality of education if you're thinking about teacher preparation and kind of well-trained, highly qualified teachers, if you're thinking about access to material resources and facilities, if you're talking about access to high-quality curriculum, rigorous AP and IB courses. There just are vast differences depending on the types of students that schools serve and the socioeconomic status of communities. And that is true both between school districts and schools and within. So you also see within high schools, for instance, that look on the surface to be desegregated, that the inequalities reproduce inside of the building where students are actually tracked into very different kinds of course experiences. So I think just fundamentally, it is a myth to say that we provide equal access to education. And when I talk about access, I'm thinking both about access to those types of instructional and material resources. And then I've also, you know, a good bulk of my work has been about studying race and identity and thinking about the ways that the stereotypes that we lay upon young people create additional barriers for them. So I talk a lot about the, you know, students I've talked to who were the one African-American student in the AP math and in calculus, and they walk into the room and the teacher says, oh, are you in the right classroom? And just the over and over again through the course of the day and the week and the school year, students having to bear the brunt of those racial stereotypes and still, you know, trying to find ways to stay engaged and succeed. So the barriers happen at multiple levels.
You're listening to On Common Ground, Economic Inequality and Education, a presentation of Spur and KQED. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to On Common Ground. We're talking about education and income inequality with Naila Suad Nasir of the Spencer Foundation, Kyla Johnson-Trammell of Oakland Unified School District, and Patrick Murphy, formerly of the Public Policy Institute of California. Murphy is about to address the question of who public education is really benefiting.
I apologize in advance if I feel like I'm dragging you into your, you know, intro to econ class, if that causes any PTSD.
We invited you to be here for those.
But you bought into it. I mean, if you think about what education does, right, it adds to the worth of the individual. I mean, that's the model. What we're trying to do is to give them more skills, give them more options, teach them to discern. And you can think of that two ways. You can think of that as the individual gets a benefit. If you have more education, typically you have a chance at jobs that pay more, just flat out pay more, right? And you can think of that as a private good, something that the individual gains. But in education as well, the reason why we provide public education, at least up through 12th grade, is that we see a public good element to that we all benefit by having individuals in our society who have more skill levels. And if you think of that as people you interact with and that's pleasant, that's great. I mean, and there's a very positive thing, and I would argue there's a moral argument for that. But I'll put that in sort of selfish, put on the sort of hardcore economist thing. We gain simply because that individual who makes more money pays more taxes, so that we can all enjoy the services that those taxes can support. And so this sort of combination of good for the individual and good for the group, good for society, I think is fundamental to providing education. And, you know, as we increasingly sort of look at education as sort of a cost center, as it were, I think we lose some of that public good notion. We still provide free K through 12 education to our students, to our children, but increasingly it's kind of been crowded out by other services that we want to provide, and we sort of have this notion that, well, there's some minimal level that we provide as opposed to trying to provide that sort of whole student approach. And in a lot of ways, we might be sort of losing track, I think, of that public good nature.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah.
Because I think it's a really important thing to think about, both the nature of the public good, what it looks like when we have a well-educated citizenry, but it's also important to think about what we're actually doing in equity terms, which is if you take, Lonnie Guinier argues that talent is equally distributed across populations, right? So any population should have an equal proportion of people who are mathematically talented, people who are artistically talented, people who are athletically talented. So where you see these kinds of differences in NAEP scores that Kyla talked about, what that really means is you are not developing the talent that exists in populations. So when you think then about the public good and the role of education in the public good, part of that is to develop the talent that exists for every single child in every single population. And where you are missing vast swaths of the population, you are leaving talent on the table, undeveloped, not to be used to solve climate change, not to be used to solve the whatever the challenges are of the next generation. So it's actually, it's an even greater loss, yep, I guess, is my point.
And Patrick Murphy, how much would Prop 13 reform get us if it was?
So let me go with just the ballot initiative that's qualified.
I'm curious what kind of numbers.
No guarantees, but right now there's a ballot initiative to reform how commercial property is assessed in California, and do it by market rate. That's going to, at least right now, if stuff could happen, I don't have a crystal ball, but it's scheduled to be on the ballot in the fall of 2020, so about a year from now. Tough to estimate the exact number, but just to keep, a ballpark again around the math, a good estimate, about the only estimate that's out there is about $10 billion more in total that it could raise. So of that $10 billion, 40%, $4 billion would go to schools. If you divide that by the number of students we have in California, that's about maybe $500-$600 more per student. It's real money. I don't want to diminish it. And at the same time, right now, that would not get us up to the national average. So that's just working through the math. I'm not offering any sense that this is a positive or a negative, but those are what the numbers would roll out.
I know it's kind of amazing when you think about, $10 billion does sound like so much, but then when you break it down in terms of how much would actually be allocated to K-12 students, $500 more, I'm sure that goes really fast. Kyla Johnson-Trammell. And so I want to play this out a little bit in terms of looking ahead. What if we sort of continue on this trajectory that we're on right now? Because I think what all of you are talking about are some pretty fundamental changes in our existing education system in terms of how we teach and how we address the needs of students, in terms of just how much we really truly need in resources. And when I think back to the very beginning of the things that you said, Kyla Johnson-Trammell, just like where we need to be focusing our efforts, from housing to work and wages to preschool and affordable childcare and enabling more children to have access to that kind of care. If we don't make those massive investments or those fundamental shifts, where do you see us going as a region, as a state? And whoever wants to jump in with their thoughts on that first.
I feel like the very health of our democracy is at stake, and we're really at a breaking point, both locally and nationally around these issues, around kind of every aspect of democratic participation. We are really struggling as a nation to figure this out. And I think it's up against this backdrop. And when we talked about the rising levels of social inequality, but we didn't really talk about the degree of those rising levels of social inequality. And when you look at like the lines on a graph that track wealth, wealth inequality or income inequality, it's quite stark. The the people on the lower end of the spectrum remain relatively flat. People kind of in the middle remain relatively flat. And when you look at the top 1 to 10%, it spikes incredibly. And so we are, and that's a product of shifts in values, shifts in the ways in which we fund our social systems, shifts in regulation and the kind of policy environment. So I guess I just feel like this is a moment where we really need to reinvest in the major pillars of our democracy, of which education and a free, high-quality public education is a major pillar. And when you look at societies who have, my colleague Prudence Carter at Berkeley talks about this, when you look at societies who have high-quality education systems, they also have lower levels of social inequality. So they go together.
Yeah, and also if I could just quickly say, it's true also, isn't it, that academic achievement right now is correlating very closely with wealth or with income, so that children from higher income families are right now achieving at much higher levels than children from lower income families. And so if you think about that stratification, it's just...
Because achievement goes with opportunity, right?
Exactly. Kyla Johnson.
Well, just one thing. That's always been the fact from the start of public education, because that's our public education system was set up to sort. So it's like the legacy of what we're trying to disrupt. I took this job knowing how difficult it is, leaning in. I think it's a moment of leaning in and not being filled with fear by how monumental the problems are that we're trying to face. And that's what worries me the most, is continuing to have this level of hopelessness, whether we're talking about climate change, educational equality, and I often tell people, like, don't lean on the superintendent, the governor, the president, the CEO to solve these problems. It's a moment of really figuring out what can the individual do. So if we go back to public education, everybody lives near a school. Have you gone to the school? Have you introduced yourself? I spent a lot of time in a lot of corporate settings talking about, you know, what are some of the simple things that you can do to invest in whatever school is in your neighborhood? Can you volunteer? Like, I feel like that is what we have missed. We have become so individualistic in this society, and so much... Yeah, money is important. Trust me, it is important. But we waste a lot of money in government sometimes, because there's other things. There's the people, there's the love, there's the connection, there are partnerships. And I think in many systems, there are bright spots. So for instance, we have had a wonderful partnership with Kaiser Permanente for probably over 10 years. That's really helped us develop school-based health centers. But it has been with the passing of Bernard Tyson, who was the CEO of Kaiser, just huge equity visionary. But we have had a wonderful relationship that has deepened through their organization, through Oakland. And so because I don't believe we're ever going to get the level of money that we need, we've got to think about all of the resources that we have. So when you put on that lens, glass half full, asset-minded, there's a plethora of resources in the Bay Area. There is no reason that we cannot solve it. We're going to have to think differently. I think we have to think more creatively about public-private partnerships. I think there's a lot more leaning in on corporations. I will give like a shout out. I was at Salesforce this morning. That's what this is for. And Mark Benioff is really, between San Francisco Unified and Oakland, we're developing a partnership of $12 to $14 million. Our principals, our middle school principals in Oakland, the middle school principals of San Francisco, we're together. And I've really been talking about what can you do to support retention? We need to talk about teacher retention and principal retention. And so I think we just need to think about it a bit differently. And yes, government needs to play its part. I think corporations need to play their part, since that's a lot of the spiking of the cost of living increasing in the Bay Area, and also the individual, the importance of volunteering, of giving back, and figuring out how to do it in a more systematic way. So yes, it could be a crisis, but there's also an opportunity to really think about the whole civic engagement and getting back to, with that being lost, there goes democracy as well.
Right. And I love that you bring up the retention piece of this in terms of the principals, the teachers, the students as well, because the concern is that we are just becoming much a more and more homogenous region, and we lose multiculturalism, we lose diversity, we lose children to be able to be educated in difference and understanding differences. Patrick Murphy, actually similar question to you in terms of where you see us going if we stay on the same trajectory. I mean, one of the economic stats I'm thinking about is the one we hear a lot, that California by like 2030 is going to need 1 million college graduates.
That's one of PPIC's stats.
Yeah. So
which we beat the drum. So if you kind of work backwards from that, that means that we need to have more students prepared for college, more students prepared for additional education after high school. Historically, California has not done well at preparing students of color, low-income students, as well as they have for other students. If you do the math and you look at the changing demographics in California, we've got to do a better job, because we won't be able to meet that goal. Again, kind of going back to that, if you will, individual self-interest thing. We want to live in a state that continues to thrive. If you go back, I'm old, so and I didn't grow up in California, but when I was going to elementary school, and so not to completely date myself, and in the late 70s, you looked at California as the best, I would argue, K through 16 education system in the world. I mean, I don't think that's hype. We seem to have backed off from that, but if you looked at what the state gained, there is a reason why California was such a driver of innovation and economy up to this point. Back off from that, as it feels like we have, at least in terms of our commitment to it or our investment in it, and you put that in jeopardy too. And that doesn't even, I'm doing the cold, you know, green eye shades look at it. The humanity that's behind that, of course, is tremendous. But if you want to look at it just from that cold hard, can we continue to thrive as a state? That raises some real critical questions.
And you raised something that we hadn't talked about here. I know we've been focused on K-12, but thinking about higher ed investment as well, and the higher ed public education system in California has enjoyed a phenomenal reputation nationally, and that is also in jeopardy with some of the backing off of state funding mm-hmm. that's occurred in the California community colleges, state colleges, and university system. So we are serving fewer of the percentage of the population of California in the UC system, just because the system has to admit more international students and more students from out of state just to kind of keep the budget solvent. So,
just to chime in on that, I mean, we've squeezed down on them. I have to give a shout out to the CSU system, because if you look at what they've done in the last 10 years, they have about 400,000 students enrolled at any one time. They have graduated more students. They have done it more quickly. In other words, less time enrolled, and have done it, as it were, across different demographics and different gaps. And that has happened not just by accident. They have worked very hard to do that. But in the world where it's easy to offer the sort of shortcomings or the somewhat, I'm a big doom and gloomer or whatever, but there's a very bright spot that with great intent, oh, by the way, we've done it with fewer resources on a per student or per graduate basis too. CSU system deserves great credit.
Well, we've gotten some really great questions from the audience, and we only have about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes left, so I want to make sure that we get some of these in. And so I'll start with this one. How are charter schools exacerbating or rectifying issues of educational inequity? Kyla Johnson-Trimmel.
Happy. Yeah. It's definitely making it more challenging because in our context, you then have more schools So you're competing for, you have more schools competing for a diminishing group of students and families. But I think it's important to look at why, where the need or where the kind of design and desire from charter schools came from. And it was never intended to get to the point, whether you're looking at Oakland, you're looking at San Diego's another example, Los Angeles, where you have just unlimited growth of a different type of public school. It was really meant to be kind of a bounded area of innovation to kind of then be learned and groomed across the district system. But like many ideas and concept, when they're implemented, that's not exactly how it's playing out. And so, you know, we do have two different types of public schools that are playing by different rules. I think in California, we're in the process of figuring out what's the right authorization and oversight process,
yes,
so that we have good schools in both types of district sectors. I would say a lot of times the argument gets too simplified because many times there are families that are choosing private. And in our city, there are more families that are choosing private than district or charter. And so a lot of it just gets to, you know, what it is that families are looking for in terms of quality schools. Sometimes it's smaller size, sometimes it's the type of program. We're seeing a huge demand around having dual language, a huge demand around Montessori, a huge demand around performing arts. And so not only sometimes are parents choosing, but for many educators, if they have a really innovative approach that creates the need for a specific type of staffing model, that creates the need for a specific type of schedule, and it's harder to start from scratch, so to speak, in a regular public school setting. Sometimes folks are then going to the charter sector because I can design it from the ground up. So those are some of the tension points around, you know, some of just the reform we need to do,
yeah,
around laws, around kind of rules in terms of how you can create schedules, how you can actually create staffing for some of the creative programming that many parents are saying, hey, these are some of the things that I want to see when I'm looking for a school for my child.
Yeah, though I am struck by your first response was to say that, yes, it is a challenge. I mean, it's a challenging,
absolutely,
aspect of it. And so I think this one's sort of for you, Naila Suad Nasir. How do we address inequity and stratification within a single school? I graduated from a San Mateo County high school, and it felt like there were two worlds under one roof, the AP-taking wealthy college-bound on one end and everyone else on the other. Note this separation mostly existed along racial lines.
Yeah. First, I want to say something about charter schools, and then I want to address that. And what I wanted to say is just that was a lovely kind of current state assessment. But I also want to recognize that the charter school movement from the beginning had multiple stakeholders and multiple purposes, right? On the one hand, there were people who thought you should create a mechanism for schools to be innovative, to serve the local community, where people who are in tune with the community can provide educational experiences for students in that community. And there were those who thought, we can do this more cheaply, we can do this and gain a profit. And so it's complicated. Now, to the question about inequality within schools, I think we know a lot about this. This is not mysterious. The problem is it's really hard to enact because people with privilege like to keep it, quite honestly. So what we know is when you want to create greater equity at the school level, you detract classes, you use instructional approaches that honor multiple ways of knowing. You provide courses that are in line with the kind of cultural experiences and cultural resources that young people bring into the classrooms. You hire a teaching faculty that mirrors the demographics of your student population. You intentionally create opportunities for extracurricular activities that build community, that don't continue to kind of reify along racial or social class lines. And schools have done this, and they've done it quite successfully. Where the opposition comes when you detract in particular, and by detracting I mean you create a curriculum such that young people from all backgrounds are coming into the same first course. So, for instance, I wrote a book with a group of teachers, math teachers from high school in the Bay Area that had detracked their mathematics courses. Everyone came in to Algebra 1 together. They taught it in a way that focused on the critical kind of concepts of mathematics, so that even if you had taken algebra in middle school, this was a new kind of teaching and thinking about algebra. And what that means is then you're starting everyone on an equal playing field, right? And then you move people through a system where you're not tracking by the experiences people have before they enter the school. So it requires intention, I guess, on the part of leadership, and it requires school leaders and district leaders to disrupt the types of differences in privilege that students and families come in with, and that's quite political and often meets lots of opposition. I'll give just one example. My son is in a high school that spent many, many years doing deep equity work, not in the Bay Area, but when we sat with the superintendent as we were looking at schools for my son, he's a ninth grader this year, he said, you know, we started this journey 10 years ago. The first month I was here, I went around and I went to classrooms and I talked to teachers and I talked to kids. And a month later, I brought all the teachers and the staff into the cafeteria and I said, we are teaching by race and zip code and it stops now. And then the board tried to fire me. And so, you know, there's significant opposition when you do this work in schools.
Well,
and I'd like to add on to that, because I absolutely agree. And I think that in most systems, every system can point to bright spots of where you're seeing your teachers and principals, where they've actually done the work. I think our challenge is, how do we do that as a system, right? Where you can point to a charter district, same problems in public schools, independent schools, and that's our challenge, is how we do it as a system, because it's a different level of training. It's a different kind of mental model in terms of the teachers and the principals to take all those what's and translate that into how. Mm-hmm. It is a skill set of standing in a room of privilege and walking people through these changes that you need to make. And back to talent, that's another area where we need to do some serious looking. How do you train people to do this equity work? People aren't just naturally born to I'm naturally born to disrupt equity. No, it's a training. It's an art. It's a science. It's not necessarily taught in our training administrative credential programs. It's not necessarily taught in our teaching credential programs. And so that's another area of reimagining, when we're looking at what are those skill sets, what are those lessons to equip folks, both with how do I teach reading, but how do I engage, how do I know how to build those relationships to actually do the work to create the conditions that we want to see.
I'm going to end with this one. It's asking, what can families do now to support students at the individual school level? And you had already touched on this a little bit, Kyla Johnson-Trammell, but I would just like each of you, because we're thinking about just really strengthening the social fabric of our region. And, you know, you talked about find out where your closest school is and introduce yourself. So if each of you could think of a strategy that the people here could take home, you know, and implement, what would it be? And please feel free to start as it comes to you. So
happy to start. I can kind of think of three ways. One I would say is just around literacy. One, it's kind of really being clear around, like, what are the talents and skills that you have. So even if we think about the whole PTA situation, so there are going to be some schools, there's just not going to be the capital there in terms of parents to actually have the means to raise anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million. There's nothing that would stop families that live in that particular community from being, I like to say, like, instead of the mom or the dad, the auntie, the cousin, where you can still actually serve the same purpose and really work to raise money on behalf of that particular school. In our district, we actually have some of our affluent schools that are now starting to raise funds and adopt a parent school. But there is nothing that would stop. You live in a school, you don't have kids anymore. I mean, you decide that you just want to actually give. You may not necessarily have the talent to work with children, but you have the talent to actually provide money to a particular program, the art program, or field trips. Another thing is when I was a principal, I had a lot of relationships with folks who lived in the community. Some went to private schools. We just talked about the individual good of your real estate's going to rise. And so being able to have folks work on beautification projects, whether it's garden projects, keeping the school beautiful, that actually has a direct impact on enrollment for people who actually do live in the community. If the school looks better, that was a lot of the feedback I got from parents, that I won't even look what's inside the school if the surrounding area doesn't look pleasing to the eye. So those are other projects where, whether you're planting trees, you decide to work in the garden, because again, those are some of the staffing shortages that teachers often have. And then the other pieces is just really looking more at policies at the city level and the state level. Part of getting folks to understand the importance of funding schools is actually getting out there. So if you have that kind of political hunger and you have the time and the energy, doing some of that work as well. So I think there are little things, volunteering, being able to give at a local level, at the school. I mean, if you see that your dollars are going to help more kids be able to go to the museum or the library, they make a difference.
I would say two things. I think one is thank a teacher. I mean, I think we have to, we live in a society where teachers have been highly deprofessionalized and quite frankly disrespected. And so I think we have to build a culture of respect for the profession of teaching. We have to build respect for teachers. And I mean, teachers have been, you mentioned, I think Kyla mentioned the activism that teachers have been engaging in with the teacher strikes. It's been really an incredible shift that teachers are striking not about their own salaries. They're striking about the resources that schools need to serve children. That is heroic work, and we should be honoring and respecting and revering our teachers, both emotionally and with prep time and structurally and with salaries. And the second thing I would say is I think we have to move beyond an us-them mentality and really think about how we as a society cultivate global-minded, multiculturally-minded citizens in our young people and in adults. And when we think about education, supporting schools, we need to be thinking beyond just people that look like us and think about what as a community do we need to be supporting around education.
And I will never profess to have much to contribute on a school level because I am as ignorant as everyone else ever on that. But what I'll pick up on Dr. Nasir's point and say thank a school superintendent. And I'm not doing that. If you will, on your way home, think about the skill set that's needed to do the job and the fact that try to think of the decision that a school superintendent to make that someone won't be unhappy about. I mean, by going in... and then try to think about a pursuit that's more important. Yeah. So thank you, Superintendent.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That is a good place to end it. Thank you, Superintendent Kyla Johnson-Trammell. Thank you, Dr. Nayula Suad Nasir, and thank you, Dr. Patrick Murphy, for sharing your insights on this issue.
On Common Ground is a co-production of Spur and KQED. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Radio post-production by Nina Thorson. Ryan Davis produces KQED's live events. Our editorial team includes Vinnie Tong, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.